I picked up a little soundbite from a film, True Detective. You might have seen it, Matthew McConaughey. And the other one, I forgot his name. But anyhow, I thought this was pretty amusing, so I cut the clip out of the film to run it for you.
Is a failure.
And I forgot to tell you, this was these two detectives had gone to this tent revival meeting. They're looking for a guy. But the conversation between the two detectives is very interesting. One is agnostic, maybe atheist, but pretty logically speaking. The other one's sort of nominal Christian, but he's a rounder, he's a whoremonger, he's a drunk. So let's listen to this interplay between these two detectives as they're standing at the back of this crowd out in nowhere's land in a revival tent.
Where is natural?
Parish FD said the church burned down 4 months earlier. No prince put out an APB on Friends of Christ. A week later, they were in Franklin. Revival ministry, old time religion. You can imagine what Mr. Charisma thought of that.
Forgetting the average IQ that this group is, huh?
Can you see Texas up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people?
Just observation and deduction. See a propensity for obesity, poverty, the yen for fairy tales. Folks putting what few bucks they do have in the little wicker baskets being passed around. I think it's safe to say that nobody here is going to be splitting the atom, Marty.
You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off the murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good.
Yeah, but the common good's got to make up fairy tales, and it's not good for anybody.
Your sorrows pin you to this place. They divide you from what your heart knows. And there are a lot of good hearts out there. I'm looking out there. I'm seeing a lot of good hearts out there. I see a lot of good out there.
I mean, can you imagine if people didn't believe what things they'd get up to?
Exact same thing they do now. Just out in the open.
Bullshit. There'd be a fucking freak show of murder and debauchery, and you know it.
If the only thing keeping a person decent is the expectation of divine reward, then, brother, that person is a piece of shit. And I'd like to get as many of them out in the open as possible.
Well, I guess your judgment is infallible, piece of shit-wise. You think that notebook is a stone tablet?
What to say about life? You gotta get together. Tell yourself stories that violate every law of the universe. Just to get through the goddamn day. What's that say about your reality, Marty?
When you get to talking like this, you sound panicked.
You think it's all a scam, huh? Mm. All them folks?
Mm-hmm.
They just wrong?
Oh, yeah. Been that way since one monkey looked at the sun and told the other monkey, he said, for you to give me your fucking share. People. So goddamn frail, they'd rather put a coin in a wishing well than buy dinner.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, your arms are open and closed. The echoes of my life can never contain to see the truth about you. You move the feather in the ash, you touch the leaf with its flame.
Transference of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel. It's catharsis. He absorbs their dread with his narrative. Because of this, he's effective in proportion to the amount of certainty he can project. Certain linguistic anthropologists think that religion is a language virus that it rewrites pathways in the brain, dulls critical thinking.
Well, I don't use $10 words as much as you, but
for a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot. And you still sound panicked.
At least I'm not racing to a red light.
Yeah, man, at least I'm not racing to the red light. That was a great intercourse between those two guys. That's funny, but it's sad too, because it's so true. And every day I live, the more it makes sense. Yeah, baby.
The wolf on the hill is never as hungry as the wolf climbing the hill.
Lone wolf is a term commonly used by many people. It means that they used to belong to a group, but left, to become stronger. By thinking and acting alone, the lone wolf acquires superior cunning, agility, imagination, and skills unknown to members of the pack. The lone wolf is independent of and distances itself from the petty bickerings, expectations, demands, mediocrities, and unfulfilled dreams of other people, groups, or organizations. The lone wolf is often branded as the rebel.
For it is the sovereign lone wolf who stands alone in all of his or her glory.
Lone Wolf Radio calling. Lone Wolf Radio calling. This is Lone Wolf Radio, and this is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in the sunny West Coast. Yeah, and it is May the 3rd, 2017. Well, it was 90 degrees where I'm at yesterday, and I don't think it's going to get that hot today, but it's pretty warm, pretty warm. Do you know we've had as high as 220,000 guest workers in this country in 1 year in the past? And that's the Speaker of the House, this jerk, this turd Speaker of the House has promoted that kind of stuff. So they climbed all over him, and he backed it down to 77,000 out-of-country workers coming in here. And that's only one section. That's not all of them. So you wonder why people can't get a job? You wonder why the GOP, the grand old party, still doesn't have the votes for health care? You went from one mess into another mess. Here's what could be on the table as the push to pass a health care bill continues. If a vote doesn't take place this week, it will be the third time that Speaker Paul Ryan, who should be dumped immediately, has failed to make his majority in Congress worthwhile. And here's the way that goes. How can you fill a country up with at least 40 million invaders from Mexico, Latin America, and all over the world coming in here? It's a lot more than 40 million. How can you dump those people on the rolls and expect to give them all health care? Now, you could have 100% health care if you had a controlled population. If we'd have kept our population about the level it was in the 50s, we'd have had no problem doing that, and everybody would have had guaranteed health services. But now, it's impossible. They're pouring so many more people into this country daily, weekly, monthly, that there's no way that you're going to be able to give them all health care. So what are you going to do now, bright boys? It was all to take care of the corporate rich that this happened. And unless it's turned around, it's not going to change, except getting worse. So there you go. Health care. Good luck, Trump. You know, they changed the law on NSA, National Security Agency, so that they weren't supposed to be snooping on you at all. The U.S. National Security Agency collected more than 151 million records of Americans' phone calls last year, even after Congress limited its ability to collect bulk phone records, according to an annual report issued on Tuesday by the top U.S. intelligence officer. Now, isn't that hunky-dory? Forget about security, privacy. Anybody that still believes in that is crazy. I see the White House is deciding whether to pull out of the Paris Accords on energy. That's going to be interesting. All is backing down from controlling the situation as far as climate is suicide as far as I'm concerned. There's enough information available to let you know that we got a big problem here. We don't have a little problem, we've got a big problem, and the left is partially right on that. The photo this winter of a smiling Mar-a-Lago guest with the uniformed military aide who carries the nuclear football was a rare and unease-inducing public reminder that just steps from the president at all times are the keys to the end of the world as we know it. Americans normally see very little of the massive apparatus that surrounds the modern presidency, and it's easy to forget that much of it exists primarily to help ensure the commander-in-chief, wherever he's at in the world, is able to access the nation's nuclear weapons and launch a retaliatory strike. They're getting ready to bomb us any minute. The communications and security infrastructure drives the enormous cost of moving a president around the country. Critics have said that the president, Donald Trump's weekend jaunts to Mar-a-Lago cost upwards of $3 million each. But even that is just a rough estimate. And of course, it's the same way with Obama and Bush and all those presidents. The true costs of presidential travel are spread through so many offices, budgets, and secret funds, and it's unlikely that even the government has any real sense of the precise cost of the White House travel. One GAO study in recent years suggests it's upward of $100 million a year just to get his white ass around the country or around the world. And in the case of Obama, it was his black ass white, black ass kids, and several of their relatives that went all over the place. With much of that price tag reflecting roughly $180 million an hour cost of flying the Boeing 747s that normally operate as Air Force One, the code name for any Air Force plane carrying the Commander-in-Chief. Can you imagine spending $100 million a year flying that Negro around for 8 years? He's probably still got some privileges today. What do you think Nathan Bedford Forrest would think about that? But that famous blue and white Boeing 747 is just the most visible symbol of presidential travel. There's much more that unfolds behind the scenes. A presidential trip involves hundreds of military and government personnel and often requires dozens of flights, including a backup for Air Force One and transport planes that move the motorcade, helicopters, and communications gear. And for short trips or smaller airports, other planes could step in too. The Boeing 757s that normally fly Vice President as Air Force 2 might be used this summer to shuttle Trump on the short hop to his expected summer escape at the Trump National Golf Course in Bedminster, New Jersey. And then there's the whole other fleet that the Air Force tries to keep out of sight. Ever since the 60s, the United States has been building and equipping a special set of planes whose sole purpose has been to evacuate the president in the event of a nuclear war and allow him to command a war from somewhere, wherever he may be. That's interesting. The airplanes, while not technically secret, are rarely mentioned. The Air Force does not even publicly acknowledge owning them, even though they are always at the president's beck and call. Through interviews, declassified records, and a careful review of the Air Force manuals and other historical documents, though, it's possible to piece together a window into this secret fleet. As it turns out, the biggest secret surrounding the fleet isn't the planes themselves. It's where the planes are supposed to land after scooping up the president, an answer that lies in the key friendship of First Lady Jackie Kennedy. Interesting. The special presidential evacuation procedures begin with the primary Air Force One planes themselves. On September 11, 2001, as President George W. Bush raced into the air following his school appearance in Sarasota, Florida, the crew activated a secret classified capability aboard the 747 that speeds aboard emergency launches, rocketing the plane into the sky at what seems to passenger and observers like an impossible steep pitch, to minimize its exposure to any lurking surface-to-air missiles. Quote, there are only two 747s in the world that can take off like that, unquote. One of the flight stewards said that day, leading over to a congressman who was aboard, and they're both called Air Force One. Then an even larger presidential fleet is kept ready for special emergency use. The Air Force has four specially outfitted Boeing 747s known as E-4B Night Watch planes that could serve as a National Airborne Operations Center. In operation since the 1970s, these airborne command posts were long considered the best chance for a Cold War president to survive a nuclear attack. Unlike the ceremonial and comfort-focused Air Force One, the E-4B airborne command posts are flying war rooms staffed by dozens of military analysts, strategists, and communication aides who would guide the president through the first days of a nuclear war. All that for these assholes. The plane also includes special gear like a 5-mile-long trailing wire antenna that would ensure the president could remain in contact with the nuclear submarine fleet even after ground-based communications had been destroyed. How does it feel to be a peasant? Yeah, a peasant. Through the final decades of the Cold War, an E-4B Night Watch plane always stood on alert at Andrews Air Force Base, ready to whisk the president skyward with just 15 minutes warning. Even today, one of these four doomsday planes, known by their crews as Air Force One when it counts, regularly travels with or near the president, particularly on overseas trips. When a president is in the United States, an E-4B always remains on alert at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska. its engines turning 24 hours a day, ready to launch and rendezvous with the president in the event of an emergency evacuation. Its engines turning 24 hours a day? Nobody's worth that. Yet even those doomsday planes represent just one corner of the emergency air fleet at the president's fingertips, all of which is easy to hide inside the large-scale logistics of a presidential trip. Yeah. A day ahead of President Barack Obama's visit to Deutschland in June 2009, a white unmarked Gulfstream III touched down at Stuttgart Airport. As with all presidential and vice presidential travel, preparations began months before the liftoff, and the U.S. military aircraft had been streaming into nearby Dresden, Germany, interesting, for weeks, shuttling staff, communications gear, security teams, helicopters, and armored vehicles ahead of the president. Tell me why any one individual is that important. That's bullshit. The Air Force groups whose missions into three main categories, codenamed Phoenix Banner, Phoenix Silver, and Phoenix Copper. A Phoenix Banner mission is a special air mission directly supporting the president. Phoenix Silver designates a flight support the vice president, and Phoenix Copper denotes flights flown in support of the Secret Service for VIPs other than the president and the vice president. The basic procedure for such flights, fill page after page of a manual, Air Force Instruction 11-289, and carefully delineate how seats should be configured on a transport aircraft. One of the six seats must be reserved for Marine One security personnel if a helicopter is on board. How presidential limousines should be loaded, driven forward, not backed in. How weapons can be carried aboard. Secret Service agents are limited to three clips of ammo on their person and three more in their baggage. Don't even trust the Secret Service. Whether alcohol can be served to passengers sometimes, and the specific tie-downs necessary for transporting various helicopters. As part of these Phoenix Banner flights, even though most of the presidential motorcade for that Germany trip would be made up of the local black Mercedes sedans, the Secret Service and the Air Force had flown to Dresden multiple heavily armored limousines, Secret Service Suburbans, and communications vans for the president, staff, and security to use. A normal configuration of vehicles known as the Secure Package helicopters from Marine One Squadron HMX-1 had been flown over board transport planes to help the president travel around Germany. I'd make the son of a bitch walk naked. But at first glance, none of that was related to at all to the $40 million Gulfstream that landed in Stuttgart, an hour's flight away from Dresden, a day ahead of Obama's Germany visit. The white unmarked jet blended in among the anonymous luxury jets that filled many major airports around the world, yet it had no apparent business in Stuttgart, and its crew hung close to the plane. It was in Germany only for a day, and then promptly took off around the time the president departed Germany for the next leg of his trip to France. As Air Force One went to Caen, the Gulfstream flew across the English Channel to the UK's Mildenhall Air Force Base, where it waited in a hangar just an hour's flight away from Obama's visit to the beaches of Normandy for the anniversary of D-Day on June 6th. Then the Gulfstream flew back to Andrews Air Force Base in the United States. On no leg of the trip did the plane appear to have any purpose whatsoever. Only someone who looked up its tail number, 60403, would discover the secret. The Gulfstream was the Air Force plane 86-0403, one of the three special presidential aircraft long tasked with evacuating the president in an emergency and preserving the so-called national command authorities, the officials with authority to launch nuclear weapons. Gee, wouldn't you like to be able to launch nuclear weapons? I don't think so, unless you're crazy. Known as C-20CS, the planes don't really officially exist. But for years, they have gone nearly everywhere the president travels, paralleling presidential trips, serving as his chameleons, blending in anonymously at airports closed by the presidential visits. But never at the same airport where the Air Force One itself is landing. During one of Bush's trips to Homestead Air Force Base in Miami in 2001, for example, a C-20C shadowed the trip, standing by at Patrick Air Force Base in Cape Canaveral. The Air Force's website doesn't acknowledge the existence of the C-20Cs. Neither did the listing of aircraft maintained by the 89th Airlift Wing, the Air Force unit at the Joint Base Andrews that runs presidential missions. As one Air Force official put it when asked years ago, quote, "Our position is that we do not have any aircraft called a C-20C. One of the only references to the plane is on the government's official master list of aircraft designations, which offers only the vaguest information on a similar Gulfstream jet known as the C-20B, explaining that the plane operates on DC power and offers upgraded avionics used for the president and other high-ranking officials. The C-20 it's then described only as a modified C-2050 when enhanced secure communications used to support senior level personnel and to provide backup for the Air Force One. Can you imagine all the fucking money spent hauling these turds around? And they are turds. The planes in the C-20C fleet, known by their tail numbers of 50049, 50050, and 60403, were delivered to the Air Force in 1985 as the Reagan administration's massive investment in continuity of government operations upgraded the government command and control systems. Like the E-4B National Airborne Operations Center planes, the C-20Cs were purposely kept a little antiquated with slightly older dial and gauge cockpits, rather than the more modern all-glass computer displays to help protect the plane from the electromagnetic pulse that would accompany a nearby nuclear explosion. But the gear aboard is top-notch, with special satellite communication networks and special classified defensive measures that would protect the plane during the attack. Over the years, a different mission have called for the plane's livery has switched back and forth between the basic unmarked white and standard distinctive blue and white marking made famous by industrial designer Raymond Loewy during JFK's administration. Regardless of how they're painted, though, wherever the president is, a C-20 seaplane is usually nearby. When the C-20C, known as the tail number 50049, traveled to the Czech Republic in April 2010 to support Obama's visit to Prague to sign the New START treaty with the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, it was an unmarked white as it was the following March 21, 2011, when it traveled incognito to Santiago, Chile, to support the president's Latin American swing. Is that a dance, the president's Latin American swing? The following year, it shadowed Obama and Air Force One on a surprise trip to Afghanistan. Too bad he didn't stay there on May 1st. I mean, he'd fit in good, just throw on one of those sheets. To mark the first anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden, its sister plane, 50050, was in Beijing for Obama's November 2009 trip. Under normal circumstances, the presidential traveling party never even sees the C-20s, but in special and often high-risk situations, the presidents have actually traveled aboard the planes. In 2000, President Bill Clinton flew anonymously aboard an unmarked C-20 Gulfstream to Pakistan. He's looking for little boys over there. He heard they had a lot of cute little boys. While another aircraft followed as a decoy a few minutes behind on the same route using the call sign Air Force One, Obama used another Air Force Gulfstream in the fleet, a standard Gulfstream 5, known in the military as C-37, to take Michelle Obama out for a date night in 2009. Well, isn't that nice? How many weeks did you have to work, peasant, to buy 1 gallon of gas for that damn plane? The main purpose of the convert Gulfstreams, however, and the reason for their secrecy is ensuring that the president maintains control of the nation's nuclear weapons. Pardon me for laughing. It can be safely evacuated in an emergency. When Obama was president, get my back, black ass out of here, man. Particularly if the primary Air Force One is disabled or attacked, or if the president can't make it back to the airport where Air Force One was located. While E-4B night watch planes are meant to be long-term command centers, the C-20 aircraft, which is smaller, much smaller, and able to carry far fewer passengers than the 747, are not meant for a long-term solution. Instead, their goal is to get the president to one of the roughly dozen major ground command posts scattered around the country from which he could securely lead the nation into war. Yeah, he's going to be right at the front of the fucking war. Hey, I'm going to be at the war. Me first. In fact, this plan was nearly activated on September 11, 2001, after Bush took off from Florida. His staff's original plan, before they realized the scope of the attacks that morning, had been to fly Air Force One to an airport near the capital, like Norfolk, Virginia, where he could transfer to a small jet like a C-20 and brought either back to D.C. or to an emergency command post. I wonder how many times he shit his pants during all that stuff. I imagine he did. The ability of the C-20s to land on a runway just half the length required for a 747 means they're agile enough to use in any airport in the world, which could be very useful if you were suddenly going to be trying to hide a president somewhere in the United States. Don't hide him out here. Specifically, if you're trying to hide a president at Mount Weather in Virginia. Since the 1950s, Mount Weather, a mountain about 45 minutes from downtown Washington, has served as a nuclear redoubt for the executive branch to hide their still white asses out. An old weather research station, hence its name, and once held conscientious objectors during World War II. That fits. The mountain was hollowed out during the Eisenhower administration to serve as a primary evacuation point for the executive branch, where the president or his successor would reconvene the remnants of the government after an attack and start to rebuild the United States. Yeah, right. Yeah. Over the years, Mount Weather, long known in government parlance by its code name High Point, has grown into a sprawling city, a government in waiting, that spent decades shrouded in secrecy until 1970s, when an accidental aircraft crash nearby led reporters and Congress to begin asking questions. What the hell are they doing in there? They hollowed out that whole goddamn mountain and they're doing something in there. I think it's flying saucers. Despite its public exposure, the facility continued operation, and on September 11th, the congressional leadership was evacuated to it by helicopter from the Capitol. It's been run since the 1980s by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which little is known to the public, oversees the government's secret continuity of planning, and today sports its own fire department and its own police force, and even a bar, well, especially a bar, known as the Balloon Sheds. But Mount Weather had a problem when it was first built. It had no plane runways, just a long grass strip, and later concrete helipads. As planes became the primary way the presidents traveled, government planners were forced to find a convenient solution to the event that a president or other senior officials needed to be brought in by airplane. The solution turned out to be just a few miles away, down at the base of the mountain in Upperville, Virginia. The sprawling palatial 2,000-acre estate of the late Paul Mellon, one of the banking kingpins, known as Oak Springs Farms, which features an odd amenity for a horse country, a paved airstrip. Paul and Bunny Mellon combined two large fortunes when they married in 1948. He is a banking heir, and she heir to the Gillette razor fortune. And they devoted themselves to horse breeding, art collecting, and screwing the public and Washington society, when they enjoyed close relationships with the upper echelon in D.C. It was Bunny Mellon, a famed landscape architecture, who worked with Jackie Kennedy in the 60s to make over a stale, worn-out garden dating to the Wilson administration into the modern White House Rose Garden. Mellon, in a 1969 interview, described her gardening aesthetic as nothing should be noticed, but the phrase also appears to help explain the couple's reclusive and publicly shy lifestyle in Virginia horse country. Given their ties to the Washington elite and their aversion to publicity, they appear to have the perfect place to hide an airfield for Mount Weather. The estate's private airstrip, which Bunny and Paul Mellon used for their own private plane, originally came into existence in the 50s, just as government miners began to carve out the bunker at Mount Weather. On charts from the early 1960s, the Mellon runway was just 3,500 feet long, sufficient, for instance, to land a Lockheed Jetstar C-140, the plane that served as the day-to-day workhorse of the Presidential Fleet Force staff and VIPs. Lyndon Johnson used Jetstars to ferry back and forth to his Texas ranch, referring to the diminutive planes good-naturedly as the Air Force One Half. By 1962, as the Kennedys became frequent guests at Oak Springs, Jackie had her own cottage on the estate. The Mellon's runway had been lengthened. including lighting for ease of night approaches. When the Reagan administration began heavy investment in continuity of government and the command and control networks in the 1980s, the Air Force selected the Gulfstream III jet, what became known as the C-20, as a replacement for the Jetstars that had long served as the smaller staff and VIP ferries in the presidential fleet. The landing requirements for a C-20 were 5,100 feet. This came from an article that had the title, "The Story of the U.S. Government's Secret Plan to Save Itself While the Rest of Us Die." That's pretty plain. I bring this stuff to you because it's a perfect example that you're living under a half-assed monarchy, not as good as the monarchies of Europe were, at least the British and the French and the German. But these clowns that can barely write their own name, a lot of them, are operating as a monarchs. And there is no democracy and there is no republic. This is a monarchy, but it's a temporary monarchy. Every once in a while they change. But they've got an agreement, so they don't shoot each other. They just sort of have a sham election and change people. That's it about the Air Force One. I knew you would like to know. I see another dumb cop has put a bullet in the back of the head of a black teenager down there in Texas. I'm telling you, cops get a bad name, but they deserve it. I mean, they're always pulling some shit like this. And as the requirements to become a cop get less and less, and we put all these guys coming back from Afghanistan that are used to blowing people away and kicking their doors in, you're going to have a lot more of this crap, and there's nothing going to stop it. So you want to play Mexican? Cinco de Mayo. Well, you want to pay the price for the avocados? You're going to have to pay. Yeah, let's see here. The price of Haas avocados from the Michoacan state, Mexico's largest producer, is the highest in 19 years. Bloomberg reports, fueled by rising demand for smaller crop yields, a 22 box of avocados was just under $28 last week, more than double the price from a year earlier. What the hell happened to the avocado groves in California here? They used to be all around where I lived down in Fallbrook, California. I guess they've just pulled up the trees and gave up the ghost and moved all the stuff down to Mexico. Michoacan price doesn't represent the entire industry, and prices fluctuate with seasons and weather. Last June, for example, the cost of a box of avocados surged to about $26.60 before dropping again. But if all these make-believe Mexicans, whites, want to get out there and spend all that money for their avocados, what the hell do I care? I never liked avocados in the first place, and they were all around me in Fallbrook, California. I could pick them up off the ground everywhere, you know. I think they're a class-type fruit. They have very little taste, and I don't understand it. Many universities continue to teach students, especially white students, that white privilege is a real and pressing problem that must be addressed to end horrible white racism. Wow. The latest example comes from the University of Iowa, which recently hosted a 3-day event called Exploring White Identity for Effective Allyship, unquote, composed of dialogue, panel discussions, and interactive exercises for the attendees. Headed up by the university's chief diversity office, the event late March had an expressed aim for white-identified people to discuss whiteness and its privileges with other white people. This can be the first step in eliminating tokenism and increasing responsibility among allies to eliminate racism, unquote, according to a flyer promoting the event. First day was a student-focused session, followed by one for the community, and the final session was for faculty and staff. Numerous campus officials were asked by the college Fix to comment on the workshop, including Elizabeth Lara, Diversity Resources Coordinator, as well as Tom Moore and Ann Bassett in Media Relations, but none did. Quote, white identity is often left out of the diversity conversation, but it is a crucial part of people and allyship. I don't know what the hell this allyship is. Creating a space where white-identified folks can discuss this, teach, and learn from each other how horrible they are, can address different challenges in eliminating racism, according to a campus document obtained by College Fix explaining the event. Quote, we are all part of the solution, the document added, and this opportunity to discuss the role of whiteness in racial justice is an important one. Wow. More public university to host whites only student retreat on white privilege. This reminds me of brainwashing in Korea way back during the Korean War when they captured white troops or our troops and brainwash them. And that's what they're doing now. This has all come around before. It's all Soviet-style Marxist training programs. If you'll watch that movie, The Manchurian Candidate, the first one, black and white, with Frank Sinatra in it. You watch that film, you'll see exactly what they're doing now as far as racial discussions and so forth and brainwashing. Make sure you watch it. You can rent it or download it or something. The Manchurian Candidate with Frank Sinatra. Well, I'm going to read to you a little bit as we close out the show about how Bibi's doing over there in Israel. From the inside, from the Jew News. Too much of the outside world, Netanyahu looks like a defiant opponent of a two-state Israeli-Palestinian peace accord. To his base on the right, he looks suspiciously like a slow-motion appeaser of Palestinians and their Western friends. Staying upright amid such pummeling crosswinds calls for a very delicate balancing act, feinting constantly to one side or the other, depending on where the pressure comes from. Right now, the strongest pressure is from his right. The prime minister needs for a shadowy victory is especially acute now because of the legal sword hanging over his head. Israeli police appear poised to recommend he be indicted on at least one of three different corruption cases they've been investigating. Netanyahu is reportedly vowing in private that he won't resign after an indictment because the country needs him. And anyway, he insists the charges are baseless. Don't they all? Don't they all? But if the indictment comes down, the pressure is to step down will be enormous. It's already growing. Netanyahu's predecessor, Ehud Olmert, resigned even before he was indicted on graft charges. Olmert had said his legal defense took too much time to do his job properly. If Netanyahu wants to defy the precedent, he'll need a rock-solid support from his fractionist coalition. The looming danger is that President Trump appears to be serious about brokering what some call the deal of the century in the Middle East. Good luck. Any compromise deal would require Israeli concessions that Netanyahu would find hard to swallow and that his allies on his right flat out reject. Trump has spent a great deal of time in recent weeks meeting and visibly strengthening bonds with Arab leaders, including Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Jordanian King Abdullah II, and Palestinian Authority Chief Mahmoud Abbas, who's due to visit the White House on May 3rd. Well, that's today. Senior Arab leaders, including the Saudi Foreign Minister Adel al-Jubeir and his top aides to Abbas, have been voicing optimism bordering on enthusiasm over prospects for peace in the Trump era. You're kidding. Trump ran for office with two contradictory Middle East messages, promising at once to be Israel's best friend and yet neutral on the issues. As with so much else, he seems unaware that his various messages effectively canceled each other out. Most of his harshest critics, present company included, were certain he was incapable of learning on the job. Recent signs suggest that the critics may have been wrong. This is making Netanyahu's entourage nervous. Israelis with ties to the Trump administration are reporting. According to political correspondent Tal Shalhoub of the widely read Walla news site, that the president wants to convene a regional summit of Middle East leaders this summer in Washington. Participants would include Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, along with Israel and the Palestinian Authority. What a clusterfuck that will be. The agenda would be based on the Saudi-led Arab Peace Initiative. The initiative, adopted unanimously in 2002 by the 22-nation League of Arab States, calls for the recognition of Israel by all Arab states for normal relations and for a declaration that Israel-Arab conflict is ended. That's not going to happen. The trade-off required Israeli consent to establish a sovereign Palestinian state along with the pre-1967 borders or their equivalent, with East Jerusalem as its capital, and a just and agreed solution on the Palestinian refugee. I'm not going to read any more because this is bullshit. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I'll tell you. Well, that's about it for today. I'm wearing out here. It's up, like I said, around, it's over 90 today. Yeah, but it's nice and cool in here in the deep down dungeon bunker. I'll be with you tomorrow on Thursday, and we'll have some more fun, okay? Yeah.
Millions are dead as long as die.
Your leaders are bigots.
Because the Pope wars on the Catholic Emperor.
Your generals are bandits.
Wars on the Catholic King of France.
You employ any mercenary you can get.
Wars on the Catholic King of Spain.
And the Pope plays politics,
helped by a hundred other princes, kings, bishops.
All for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you. Religious fanatics who incite murder for the sake of a god they have never known. Don't you understand? There is no God!